four bills before us, and we're going to start with Senate File 579. We'll continue the testimony for Senator Bonham's bill on early childhood development screening. And we'll hopefully be in a position to take action within the next 15 minutes or so.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I want to remind members that in our hearing, I believe it was Monday, the bill was amended, and that amendment is now been recorded and accepted. And we had begun speaking about the ECFE portion of the bill, and we took testimony on that, and now we're talking about the we're skipping around. Oh, Karen's here. Okay, very good. And we are now talking about the developmental assessment at kindergarten entrance. And so if you look at your bill, that begins with Section 5.
Okay, Section 5 of the bill. Members, and does each one have the amendment? That? Okay, please proceed, Senator.
Okay, so what we're doing in this section is establishing that the Commissioner of Education will implement a developmental assessment at kindergarten entrance to all school districts on a voluntary basis, and voluntary is a key word in that paragraph, using the model developed for the school readiness studies. Then, if you look down in Subdivision 2, what we're trying to get at here is making sure that with limited funds that we are targeting our students who are most at risk first. And the amendment that has been adopted puts the words up to before each of the percentages in 1, 2, 3, and 4, so that we're in consistent with the voluntary nature of the bill. And then to speak about the kindergarten assessments, Dr. Karen Cadigan.
Okay. Welcome again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I regret to inform you I'm not technically a doctor, although in my free time I'm pursuing that and developing some early childhood measures, actually. My name is Karen Cadigan. I'm the Director of Outreach and Public Policy at the University Center for Early Education and Development. I teach graduate-level classes on assessment of infants, toddlers, and preschoolers, and do a significant amount of consultation work on assessment, most recently for the U.S. Department of Defense Worldwide Schools. I'm also a nationally certified school psychologist. I worked in public schools for 7 years and have personally been involved in assessment teams of over 1,000 children. All of those children were being evaluated for individual decisions, and so they were team-based approaches, parents very involved. It's worth mentioning that because that's a very different kind of assessment than what this is. So to begin with, it warrants mentioning that the definition of assessment broadly is the collection of information for the purpose of making a decision. And any time that we're talking about educational assessment or testing, I think it can be a sticky issue because people tend to already have preconceptions in their mind about how useful that may be, how dangerous it may be. And I just want to invite you to sort of be open to possibilities of how this might be useful for us, keeping an eye on the progress of Minnesota's preschoolers. So the main purpose of assessment is to make a decision, very important thing to keep in mind. The Minnesota School Readiness Assessment was developed with the help of a couple of national leaders in the field based on a tool called the Work Sampling System. I'm going to guess that you have heard testimony on the Work Sampling System and the results of that somewhat recently. Am I right in making that, or do you need me to go into the whole history of it? I can quickly
Perhaps not the whole history, but a brief overview. And
sure, sure.
We'll follow up as
And actually, I brought a handout on Monday. I don't know if that's still here or not, but it had the picture of the kids down the side.
So it should be here.
If you happen to have that with you, it may be helpful. So the what, when, who, and how, this assessment tool is one of the kinds of things that are useful in a toolkit of assessments. Another kind of assessment that we might be familiar with is a test. Tests are things that give actual scores. The Minnesota Developmental Assessment is not a test in that it doesn't assign a child a score. It simply describes their behavior in one of three categories: proficient, not yet proficient, and in progress. The tool is developed by the Minnesota Department of Education in conjunction with some national leaders to be useful specifically in Minnesota. One of the reasons this tool was chosen was that many kindergartners already use this tool in their classrooms. Certainly in doing this kind of broad assessment, you want to be not only reliable and useful, but doable. So in order for it to be doable, it needed to be familiar to teachers. This tool is actually, this is an important point. This tool is based on a four-year-old standard. This is a preschool evaluation. It's an evaluation of how are Minnesota's preschoolers doing. But because we don't know where preschoolers are, and it would be difficult to get a random sample of them, in part because of our lack of a system, we had to do the evaluation at kindergarten entrance. So it's given in the first 6 weeks of kindergarten. So, and that's an important point because you can understand then that most of the children that take this are actually five. And so when we're seeing the results that we have seen over the last 3 years, it's actually quite a conservative estimate of what children know and can do. The goal of this is to assess children's proficiency in one of five, in all of the five domains. It is not to evaluate whether children are ready for school or not. This tool is not used for individual decision-making for the state's purposes. Now, teachers may use it in their classroom to inform instruction, to realize, for example, that Michael isn't quite up to snuff on his math area, and so it informs the teacher that she needs to do a little extra work with a particular child. But it's been referred to sometimes as a screener or as a diagnostic tool by others, and it is not that, and that needs to be made very clear. So to get to the, to sort of skip to the end, because I know there's a long list of testimony today, the results of this have shown a pretty consistent, but I think disturbing pattern, which is right in line with national trends. That is, kids who come from backgrounds whose parents have a low level of education, especially high school only or no high school, fare worse than kids who come from families with higher maternal education. Not new news. So you might wonder, well, why should we keep using this evaluation tool if it keeps on painting the same picture for us? I think that this is where we get into discussions about what is the decision to be made. And the intention of this bill, as I understand it, is the decision is sort of, is Minnesota making progress as a state? And can districts compare between district to district how places are doing in terms of the interventions they're providing for young kids? There have been attempts.
Excuse me, Ms. Cadigan. May the record show a quorum's present in the room?
Another interesting point is that you might think, well, so what do we know about the children who are not yet proficient or who are in progress? What do we know about their backgrounds? What kind of programs were they in? I mean, if we knew that all those kids, for example, were in family, friend, and neighbor care, we might think, okay, let's look at family, friend, and neighbor care. It has been all but impossible to collect those data reliably because many parents, two reasons. One, many parents aren't exactly sure what the name of the program is that their child is in. And secondarily, most importantly, is that most children are in two or more care settings. So it's sort of hard to determine in this study which has the bigger effect, which care setting has the biggest effect on kids' outcomes. The snapshot of the findings is essentially over the last 3 years from the department that around, this is roughly around 10% of kids are not, or a little less, are not yet ready for school. In some ways, that's also consistent with special education numbers. So it's not that we shouldn't be concerned about the kids who are not yet ready, but there are systems in place to care for kids who have identifiable delays and disabilities. Around half of our kids, depending on the domain you're looking at, are proficient. That is, when they're entering kindergarten, they're proficient at a level that we'd expect for four-year-olds. So that's good. But around 40% of kids are not yet proficient at a four-year-old level. This is consistent data over 3 years, excellent quality samples that the state has done. And so it does warrant some attention, I think, to collect more of those data to examine how we're making progress, and maybe other attention to what is, for those kids that are in progress, some of them are on a trajectory line where they're probably going to be fine, but some of them are not, and we're not exactly sure who's where and who's going to make it and who's not, so it probably does warrant additional attention. I have a lot more I could say, but I'm going to stop for now, and thank you for hearing my testimony. I'd be happy to take questions.
Thank you, Ms. Carrigan. Questions? Okay. Please proceed, Senator Bonneff.
Thank you. So at this point, then I would move to the next part of the bill, which is the parent education grants. And this, these have been...
Page 3, 3.27 members just arriving. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This has been added to the ECFE bill because we know that when we look at communities at risk, when we look at the various people all over our state, not just in the Twin Cities area, there are several organizations that reach out to these children at risk and trying to make a difference in this area. So we're recognizing that there is no one-size-fits-all approach, and so we're allocating some funds to other organizations that are serving the same goals. So I have two people here to testify about some of those programs. Thank you very much. I have on my right, just want to make sure I say your name right, Mary Kate Stranick, very good, from the chair of the National Parenting Network. So if you want to start.
I am the chair, the chairperson of the National Parenting Education Network, Madam Chair. I think you are chair now, right?
For a few moments.
Right, or Chairperson Weiger, I guess. But I'm really going to be speaking from my local experience also, although it does reflect the national picture. And my local experience is that I'm a family program consultant at this point and a nurse and from public health by background. But for about 30 years, I was involved with MELD, Minnesota Early Learning Design, which is a peer self-help model of parenting education, which we designed in Minnesota and currently is being done all over the United States. And eventually I was director of MELD, and MELD is now merged with PAT in St. Louis, Missouri, PAT being Parents as Teachers. So I thank you for the opportunity to testify here today in support of Senate File 579, Support Parents, Education Begins at Home. And in particular, I'm going to focus on the Parent Education Grant section, as Senator Bonhoff mentioned. And I want to emphasize the importance of parent choice in this regard. Minnesota has a huge variety of organizations that are doing parent education with families who face many challenges that could be low income, immigration, single parenthood, unemployment, special needs children. And as many of the leaders, the evaluation leaders in our field, have said to us over and over again, is that matching parents to programs and matching programs to parents is really an essential characteristic of success, both for the parent and for the program. Parents need to be met where they are, in environments that are comfortable for them, and at times when they are available. They are often most comfortable when parent educators are people like themselves. And the reason that this is so important is that so that they can see by example and by modeling that they too can have children who can succeed. Parents need to have choices that will match their needs. I handed out just a single sheet of paper that is titled with the testimony for this bill, and it's undertitled Examples of Community Organizations Doing Parent Education, and it was at the last session. It should be in your packets or maybe on your table also. So
we do have that.
You have it? Okay, thank you. This list is by no means complete, and nor is it meant to represent the biggest or even the best of the programs, the variety of programs, but rather to indicate the breadth of organizations that understand the importance of parenting education and have programs to fill the gap with the people that they serve. In other words, they're already serving people, and they recognize that these people need and don't have access to parenting education. So you can see by the list, I'm not going to read it because you have it in front of you, but you can see that they come from many different perspectives. There's the parenting education perspective, the housing organizations, juvenile justice organizations, churches, and we'll hear more about that in a minute from Bruce, health organizations, community or ethnic perspectives, employment programs, programs that are focused on the child, and many of these have very comprehensive services, which is important for families that need them to go to one place to get a lot of services at the same time. All of these programs, or not all of these programs, but these programs offer different kinds of services. So some of them will be home visiting, some of them will be group work, some of them are mentoring, and they're also all done by different kinds of providers. They are done by parent educators, social workers, peer facilitators, community members, nurses, as some examples. I think I just wanted to wrap up by saying that all of these programs must be held to quality programming and to best practices and to good evaluation. And I ask that you seriously consider the parent education grants as an essential part of this bill to assist in serving families in a variety of ways.
Thank you very much. Mr. Bjork, welcome.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Reverend Bruce Bjork, and I'm the Director of Programs for the Greater Minneapolis Council of Churches. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm here today to speak in support of this bill, and in particular the provision that provides for parent education grants for organizations that provide services to at-risk and underrepresented parents and families. Over the past several years, the Greater Minneapolis Council of Churches has worked closely with literally hundreds of faith-based and community-based organizations that provide a wide range of services to families in need of support. And I am convinced that any effort to support families in our communities must include the small grassroots organizations that have the greatest potential to reach the hardest to serve. Even well-resourced and highly successful programs find it difficult to reach into every community and serve every family in need of support. And in the state of Minnesota, the unserved and the underserved are disproportionately communities of color and people living in poverty. Our efforts may be well-intentioned, but a program, even a very good one, is of little consequence if families are failing to take advantage of the opportunities that are made available to them. And I would argue that a family that chooses not to participate in a program does not see that program as a real or viable opportunity at all. Our responsibility as a community is to ensure that critical services are made available to everyone in ways and in forms that are accessible to those who are most often excluded from the process. And resourcing community organizations is one of the most promising ways to ensure that services are accessible, culturally competent, and sensitive, all of which are characteristics of effective and accountable programs. Now, I'm particularly interested in and supportive of grants to community-based organizations to include secular nonprofits and faith-based organizations because of the comprehensive nature of the benefits that will result when we direct resources to agencies and programs that are the closest to the people we most want to serve. These benefits include, for example, engaging new partners. We have a tremendous pool of resource in our communities, in our churches and small grassroots nonprofits. Directing resources to those organizations will engage new partners. It's also an opportunity for us to promote innovation. to look for new ways to provide services and to complement and supplement and extend services that are already available. It will create an entrepreneurial environment, encourage social service capitalism, if you will. It will provide for a more sustainable effort. Engaged community partners are most creative and are most likely to be engaged in delivering those services when resources become even more scarce in the future. It's also an opportunity for us to encourage the validation of new best practices in the field of parent education and early childhood. Mary Kay mentioned the importance of best practices. We have found that when you're talking about small faith-based and community-based nonprofits, best practices don't really exist. This is an opportunity for us to validate best practices. Best practices tend to be restricted mostly to large, well-resourced organizations, and this is an opportunity for us to see what churches and small nonprofits really can do and what they can do well. It's an opportunity for us to learn what is possible, to learn what works and what doesn't. Resourcing community-based organizations to deliver parent education services is more than a matter of paying for critically needed services. It's also a community development enterprise, an investment in social capital and community infrastructure that could have enormous payoff in the future. I would suggest to you that the payoff of this kind of investment is certainly no less significant than many of the development projects we currently invest our public resources in. We need to explore new ways of addressing old problems, problems that too often seem immune to the solutions we want to try. We need to explore ways to develop solutions that cross the many sectors of our community, solutions that include government, business, private nonprofits, and the faith community. We need to find solutions that include and involve us all, solutions that acknowledge that we all have a role to play, solutions that acknowledge that there needs to be shared responsibility. We have worked for years in providing services to the community through small faith-based and community-based nonprofits. It works, and I strongly encourage you to support this bill and, in particular, Section 6. Thank you.
Thank you, Reverend Bjork. And Senator Bonner for the comprehensive presentation. We do have Dr. Karen Ephraim, I believe, that wanted to testify. And members that have just joined, we have Senate File 579 as amended. We'll entertain amendments after Dr. Ephraim, and our intent is to move the bill soon. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Karen Ephraim. I'm a mother of three, a pediatrician, and a policy analyst for EdWatch. Unlike the other bill that Senator Bonhoeff had in the last committee, this one raises multiple concerns, and I will try and summarize them briefly. And I just want to say that these concerns were shared by other groups as well as both members from both sides of the aisle in the House when this was dealt with in the policy committee this last week. Number one, vague and subjective criteria for inclusion. The language on line 114 says that this program is for parents and children, quote, who may be at risk of not being ready for kindergarten. We appreciate Senator Bonhoeff's mention in her discussion of the bill that she sees it as children that qualify for free and reduced lunch, but the language, the specific language of which children are to be considered at risk is not at all clear in the bill. Number two, putting into state law the outcomes for 0 to 5 from the Departments of Human Services and Education, respectively. I have tried multiple times to get a hold of the 0 to 3 guidelines and have still been unable to do so to even evaluate them. So I can't comment on them, but I will comment on the 3 to 5 guidelines from the Department of Education. And we unfortunately see these as a resurrection of the kind of outcome-based education things that were very much a problem in the whole discussion of the profile of learning, which this body wisely rejected by wide bipartisan majorities. And we also fail to see how teaching children at age 3 and 4 about issues of relating to gender, family structure, diversity, careers, environmentalism, et cetera, will do anything to deal with the achievement gap. And that also brings us to the assessment, which is being used, is based on these standards or outcomes, and is being used to say that 50% of Minnesota kindergartners are not entering ready to learn, which is a problem. And they are, you know, the numbers are being used in multiple ways. When the Commissioner of Education herself has said that really only 11 to 12% of children are not having any of those skill sets, and the rest are either proficient or on a track to be proficient, there's a significant amount of confusion and potential expansion of programs that may not be necessary. And in the House hearing on the kindergarten assessments, even the people that were training the kindergarten teachers to give it admitted that there are problems with the validity of this assessment. And this is for, you know, it deals with 5 domains, and even in the areas of math and reading, which are less controversial, the items on the assessment as well as the standards are very vague and subjective. We appreciate that Senator Bonhoff is saying that the percentages and the giving of the assessment is voluntary, but it's not clear whether they're voluntary for the school or for the children taking them, and whether there's any kind of opt-out or opt-in for this assessment. The bill promotes programs whose claims of long-term effectiveness are not supported by the research evidence, specifically home visiting, where national studies in 1999, 2004, and 2005 show that these programs do nothing to decrease child abuse rates. They can cost, comprehensive services can cost up to $47,000 per family in 1999 dollars and do nothing for the cognitive development of the children. Several studies have clearly stated that they do nothing for the mental development or the socio-emotional development of the children. And there are multiple concerns raised about consent issues, data collection, Fourth Amendment concerns, and unscientific or biased information presented to families. And ECFE, despite the universal love of this program, legislators on both sides of the aisle admit that it doesn't meet research-based criteria from the Governor's Summit for improving academic achievement. In addition, the legislative auditor in 2001, after reviewing 4 or 5 national studies, said, quote, studies of 2-generation programs like ECFE have generally found small or no effects on child development, although many have reported some positive impact on parenting skills. And if that's what we're trying to do, fine, but if we're using this as a way to improve development, cognitive development or academic achievement, I don't think this is the program to do that. And then the parent education programs in Section 6 smack of the state setting norms in all the areas listed and potentially imposing the state's views of how children should be parented. And that is a concern, considering that there is nowhere near a consensus among expert groups. There's wide cultural variation, and there's significant constitutional concerns, especially in the socio-emotional area. So I could give you more details, but I thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Dr. Ephraim. On the point you made on not getting guidelines, copies of guidelines from the department, if someone's here from the department, maybe you could talk to them later, or And it would be our expectation that anything published you would have access to. And I do see some of the reps, so enough said on that, but to make sure you get that. Senator Olsen, and then we would like to look at a motion and any possible amendments or questions. Senator Olsen.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Dr. Ephraim, we might as well just pack up and go home because our kids are doing great. I guess in your world there's no problems, but in my world, 25% of the kids are on free and reduced meals. The families are in big problems, and you're just telling me that ECFE doesn't work? Well, I believe it works real well in the school districts that I represent. So I'm having a little hard time listening to what you're telling me, that 11 to 12% of kids, according to Commissioner Segrin, are the only ones that aren't ready for kindergarten. I don't think that's true. I think that if you go into the kindergartens in the area that I represent, you'll find that there's a lot of kids there that need a lot more help than 11 to 12%.
Mr. Chairman.
Dr. Ephraim.
Senator Olsen, if you actually look at the long-term results of academic performance, as I mentioned in the last hearing on the other bill, United States kindergartners are actually doing quite well long term, and that is what we need to look at. And in addition, all of the studies show that that early childhood programs really have no long term impact beyond the third grade. So if you're dealing, if you can look at kindergarten readiness, but you also have to look at what effect kindergarten readiness actually has on long-term academic performance. And at grade four, when the evidence of the effect of kindergarten or pre-kindergarten programs would be most apparent, we are actually doing fine. It is not until 8th and 12th grade that American students fall to the bottom of the international heap. And there's also evidence that these programs may actually do some academic and emotional harm if you start them too early.
Okay. Members, Senator Bonhoeff moves that Senate File 579 as amended be recommended to pass and refer to finance. Thereupon, if passed, it would go to the E-12 funding division. Discussion. Senator Olsen.
I need to just do a quick follow-up.
Quick.
Because it'll be quick. The home visits. We have, before we drop the program in one of the districts I represent, you know, they're going into homes where there's no drapes on the windows. These people don't know how to raise kids. These people are working with these families to help them raise their children. And you're telling me that's harming? There's statistics that show that that's harming. That I don't know where you're coming from, but there are people in this world that need help. And I just feel that's pretty coarse.
Okay, Senator Olsen, I think we're getting personal. let's vote if we're ready. Senator Bonhoeff?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, just one thing. I do want to clarify that it is voluntary for parents, too, so if I need to do something about that language, make sure council, if you would just help look at that language with me to make sure it is voluntary for parents and the school district. Thank you.
That's noted. Council will further review that on its journey. There being no further discussion, all in favor indicate aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Carried. Thank you, Senator Bonhoeff. Senator Moi, Senate File 646. And, Senator, if you could ask your witnesses to join you at the table. This address is electronic and internet intimidation and bullying prohibition in schools. We do have a number of people that are going to testify in behalf of the legislation. And I'll mention as well, Senator Saltzman has an amendment she may be offering, but has a witness that will also talk about additional related items as she's been working on that. Welcome, Senator Moi.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you so much for the opportunity to present this bill to you. First of all, I should just tell you that I am so proud and so excited to have a chance to have this initiative heard. This area actually has, for a long time, been of interest to me, obviously for a number of reasons. You know, growing up as a child of color in this country, I'm not a stranger to the kinds of bullying that have taken place in my own life. And so I'm particularly sensitive. I'm particularly sensitive to this area because I recognize that although it's not always motivated by racial or ethnic differences, I mean, children will just do things because that's what children do. But I do have a particular sensitivity to this issue. Also, since I've become a parent. And since my children are now entering the school system, I'm becoming much more sensitive to what my children are experiencing in the classroom. And so this area has been of a long time interest to me to try to do something about it. And this year, when the Attorney General came to me with this initiative, I felt like something that was of interest to her came in line with my own personal interests. So I am proud to present to you an initiative that came from the Attorney General's office, but absolutely and accurately reflects my own interest in moving forward. Just very briefly, I just want to also share with you that I was inspired to carry this bill in part because having been the state senator representing Senate District 67 for the last 5 years, I've had a unique experience with a school in my Senate district, Battle Creek Middle School, that have implemented an anti-bullying plan in the school building that has been tremendously successful. And so having been tracking that, I know firsthand how useful this policy is. So I am here to present to you Senate File 647, which is really two sentences.
646.
Two sentences, really. And the new language just asks that we ask that school board adopt a policy to address bullying, but we want to extend that to addressing intimidation and bullying in all forms, and in particular including electronic forms that may involve the internet use. And the rationale, Mr. Chair and members, is just that simply the Journal of Medical Association has estimated that almost 30% of teens are involved in bullying, either as a target or a bully, and that the National Education Association estimates that more than 160,000 children stay at home from school every day because of intimidation. We also know that from 2005 to 2006, the number of children who have logged on to MySpace.com has increased by almost 183%. And we also know that every day an estimated 45 million children go online. And so what we're seeing in the classroom, what we're seeing in the playground, we know is being played out on the internet and other opportunities that children have. And members and Mr. Chair, I hope that you will give support and due consideration to Senate File 646. I have with me today a number of individuals who are here to testify in support of this bill. We will start with Dr. Walter Roberts, who is a counselor and an expert really on cyberbullying.
Thank you, Senator. Welcome, Dr. Roberts.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I do have a handout if I can get a legislative aid here.
Please proceed.
Thank you. My name is Walter Roberts, Jr. I'm a professor of counselor education at Minnesota State University, Mankato. My research and focus background is in the area of bullying prevention and safe schools. I'll give a brief statement now and be available for any follow-up questions that you might have as I move
forward. Dr. Roberts, if the mic could be a little closer, please.
Absolutely. How's that? Is that better? Thank you. I think it should be noted I've never been accused of being soft-voiced, so my students would really appreciate that. I've been asked to share examples why Senate File 646 is important to the children of Minnesota. What do we know about the rates of cyber intimidation? This is a relatively new area of research, and I would like to direct the committee's attention, if I can get assistance with handing out. I do have some graphs here that I can refer to as I move forward. I would like to direct the committee's attention to the graphs included in my prepared statement. Those graphs represent just a small part of the research that was done by two researchers in 2005 of over 1,300 adolescents nationwide who used the Internet. From the graphs that you are supplied with today, you can see that of those who indicated that they had been bullied electronically, nearly 40% indicated that they had been disrespected in some fashion, 18% were called derogatory names, almost 14% had had rumors spread about them, 5% had been threatened at a level which made them fear for their own safety. Chat rooms, computer texting, and email comprised the top three locations where cyber intimidation occurred. Most disconcerting was the fact that as much as 40% of those who received such treatment told no one about receiving that kind of cyber intimidation. So what do we know about what's happening here in Minnesota? In early February of this year, I did a snapshot survey of school counselors across the state. Minnesota school counselors deal extensively with cyberbullying at all grade levels. This is a K through 12 problems. They report that it is not uncommon to have to deal with some form of cyber intimidation every 2 to 3 weeks in their particular school. Some examples of the incidents that they reported include the sending of hate email, the spreading of rumors, usually of a sexual nature, creating websites where students can vote for the ugliest or the least popular student, threats and name calling, morphing student faces onto pornography or other unflattering photographs, the uploading of embarrassing photographs on videos and websites, the theft of passwords, and the changing of personal information on profile pages to make it appear as if the owner engaged in illegal activities such as prostitution or drug dealing. In a similar incident, passwords were stolen and the owner's homepage changed to make it appear as if the individual used drugs, which subsequently placed that particular female athlete in jeopardy of losing her entire athletic ability. The most frequently named sites or messaging vehicles where such abuse took place were MySpace, YouTube, Facebook, Instant Messenger, and Zynga. Some sites are set up, it seems, to encourage mischief. These include sites such as Hot or Not and School Scandals. Many of these cases, as you might well imagine, created a tremendous amount of disruption in the overall ability of students to learn in the school setting. If threats were made, law enforcement was notified, usually with the involvement of a school liaison officer if one was available. In some instances of threats, school was canceled until either the threat was eliminated or it was verified that the threat was a hoax. Students in our schools are not the only ones who are subject to such humiliation at the hands of the cyber intimidator. Some of you may have heard of instances within your own school districts where teachers or principals have been victimized. If you're familiar with them, it's probably because those incidences made the news, and also because there were accusations made about those individuals, teachers, and or administrators being accused of sexual impropriety with students in the districts. Needless to say, such instances can have the potential for career-ending consequences. The rate and severity of cyber attacks on both students and educators is increasing in Minnesota schools, and without some sort of additional protection, will only continue. I thank you for this opportunity to testify on behalf of the bill.
Thank you, Professor Roberts. And we'll hold on questions until the presentations are over. Senator Waugh?
Mr. Chair, our next speaker is Mr. Peter Christensen, who is the principal at Battle Creek Middle Elementary, which is in my Senate district. I'm really pleased and proud to have him here to give some real-life meat to what it is that the intent of what it is we're trying to do.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, first of all, I am currently the principal at Battle Creek Middle School. I was for the last 10 years until 21 hours ago when I was named the executive director for high schools in St. Paul. But nevertheless, I want to talk for a second about what we did to address the changing of the ethos of the school and deal with bullying. Back in 1999, we instituted a program called Panther Pride, and for as cute and precious as it sounds, we talked about the three P's, and that is being prepared and punctual, those things which are obviously very important in a school, but third and last but not the least important is being polite. And we chose that route rather than going the very popular route of talking about respect for reasons of students oftentimes wearing the respect badge as a chip on their shoulder and demanding respect in ways that is counterproductive to the institution. We've also been a place that's been visited by the National Middle School Association when they had your annual convention in 2003 as a demonstration site for schools to learn about what we've been doing at our place. We also, in addition to doing our Panther Pride program, instituted a program of mentorship where we have teachers and other staff, adults in the building, volunteer their time for pay during their prep time after school and on weekends to work with students that we identify as needing that kind of mentorship in their lives, these clear-thinking, helpful adults who are not, in fact, their teachers, but rather they are their mentors, to deal with students who are social isolates in particular and to fold them into the life of the school. What's been happening recently in reference to the information that you just heard from Professor Roberts is very real and alive in our schools. Monday mornings are always an adventure. To have the opportunity to come to school, and as we monitor students walking the building and try to do that early introduction to problems by assessing what the looks on their faces and having the small community that we have of having approximately 700 students and having a house concept, a team concept, where each one of those students has a administrator to report to, and they have 175 students only to deal with, has really helped us in being able to do that. But nevertheless, the indiscretions and the indelicacies that adolescents heap upon each other through the internet is real and alive in our schools and is a challenge for us. We can establish the ethos of the school and have the culture be as positive and warm and accepting as we can, but the damage that's done over the internet is something that we have to do damage control for altogether too often.
Thank you, and congratulations on your new position.
Thank you. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members, the next speaker is Mr. James Backstrom, who is the Dakota County Attorney.
Thank you very much, Senator. It's an honor to be here today to testify in support of this bill. And, Mr. Chair, I'm James Backstrom, Dakota County Attorney, President-elect of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. I have taken on the issue of bullying prevention in my office very directly over the last 4 years. I've launched an anti-bullying program through my office where I personally go out and speak to elementary school students throughout Dakota County. And the reasons I do that and the reasons their county attorney is there in person is because this is a serious, huge issue that has far too long been overlooked by most adults in our society. Far too many parents believe that bullying behavior is no big deal. When you look at some of the Minnesota student survey results in recent years, up to 49% of parents think that bullying behavior is something that's not a concern. You know, I think that tells us right there the seriousness of the problem that we have, because as Senator Mao has mentioned, you know, as many as a third of students are harassed daily by bullies, and as many as 75% of young people at one point in time in their life are going to fall victim to bullying behavior. It is a huge issue that affects students' well-being, both psychologically, emotionally, and academically. And that's why it's good to see this bill, you know, talking about the academic side of it. You know, and when you think about the cyberbullying behavior, you know, I think it has really become a significant problem in the last 4 or 5 years and risen dramatically. And it's part because of the fact that, you know, the cyber bullies use these email messages and web logs with a sense of anonymity, that they think they can say anything they want to say over the internet, and they will often say things that they would never say to anyone in person. And that's the anonymity that comes with the use of the internet and the web journals or the blogs and the instant messaging that we see. And some of these comments that I have seen right in my own county that have been presented to me have just been so derogatory it's hard to describe. And I can see why so many parents are upset by it. You know, it's the technology itself that allows the users to inflict the pain without being forced to see its effect. And that's why we need to try to put a stop to it. And the level of brutality associated with this, when you combine that with the lack of impulse but control with adolescents, it is shocking and alarming to see what's going on. And I think there's something about this anonymity in the medium itself that coarsens the level of conduct, as I've said, and can really cause some significant damage. I think it's also important to keep in mind, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, that when you think about the levels of school violence that have erupted across our country, I'm talking about the extreme school violence, and fortunately they are few and far between, but we have had a couple of those tragedies right here in Minnesota in recent years, in Cold Spring in Red Lake, that have taken lives. And according to the studies that have been done of all the incidents of school shooting violence that have erupted over the last decade in America, 75% of the perpetrators of those offenses were the victims of bullying behavior. Now, I'm not trying to make an excuse for anyone who would commit violent crime. There is no excuse for that. But we have to, as a society, recognize the significant impact that this type of behavior unchecked can result in. And that's why it is so important that we start early and as quickly as possible in our schools to send the messages out about the need for respect. Thank you for allowing me to be here and be a part of the support of this proposal.
Thank you, Mr. Backstrom.
Mr. Chair and members, we have Mr. David Voigt, who is an Assistant Attorney General here. He's not going to give any comments, but he's here to answer questions on behalf of the Attorney General's office. I think this brings my group of testifiers to an end. So let me just close with a couple of comments. People have expressed a concern to me that what happens to the hours of the children when they're outside of the classroom or outside of the school building, in their homes, while they're on the internet, should be an arena that belongs to, you know, the parents in the home. And we're overreaching by trying to bring the schools into that arena. And I understand that, and I hear that. But what we've heard today with these testifiers is that what happens in the home and on the internet have a very strong and dramatic impact once those children arrive at school. Because under the anonymity of the exchanges that might have taken place while the individuals are far and apart from one another, when they encounter one another in cyberspace, they will be seeing each other face-to-face the next day or come Monday when they see each other face-to-face. And so there are implications for whatever happens in the home, in cyberspace, once the children comes into school. And this bill, the intent of this bill is not for the schools or for teachers or the school administration to usurp the role of the parents in regulating their children's activities at home. But it really is to start the conversation about a partnership that has already begun with what we have under current law for schools to put in place anti-bullying policies. It's just saying that this partnership now extends to the activities that are taking place in cyberspace. And it's just asking parents and teachers and school buildings to be more sensitive, more aware, and in partnership to take a more active step to protect our children and to take a more active step to intervene in the instances where the child is not the target but the perpetrator, which is equally as important as it is to step in to intervene and protect the one who is the target. We're ready to take your questions. I thank you for your consideration.
Senator Romo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, everyone on the panel right now. As a former school board member, I appreciate the gravity of the bullying situation in our schools. My question is, and I support your initiative, my question is, how do we enforce something like this?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Rummel, I don't think that the enforcement is not the end game. I mean, there's no section in this bill that says we have to write somebody a ticket or we have to, you know, cite somebody. What I'm hoping is that by leaving the policy broad, it will give an opportunity for school districts to think about this. They can draw upon the number of models that are out there, draw upon the experts of people like Dr. Roberts to help look at the details of how to implement something like this. I think it's more important to put in place measures, not necessarily punishment and enforcement, but measures like if something like this happened I would hope that it would be included in whatever policies that's implemented, that the schools and the parents are in touch with each other. So that if my child is the one who is perpetrating the bullying, I am aware that that's happening, and I can take steps then to intervene in my home. If my child is the target, I would hope I would know about it so that I could then take steps at home to convey a sense of protection and a haven for my children. So I think that the intent here is not necessarily to prescribe a punishment or an enforcement, but to put in place a general encouragement that policies would be put in place to help intervene.
Thank you. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Moore. As I look at your bill, I'm trying to understand and listen to this testimony, which is powerful, how extending the policy, what can happen as a result of a changed policy that could actually lead to some behavior change? The couple comments that Mr. Backstrom made kind of really hit me, that one is that he's learning that parents, by and large, don't regard this as a problem. And the other one was that on the part of these young people, a lack of impulse control. That's a sign of some major cultural difficulties that I think we can all speculate about. But this is a tough order. And I do agree that your bill it opens that up and realizes that this, in many ways, it's gotten out of our hands, that how it can actually be addressed by a policy that is set at the school to actually change this.
Mr. Chair, Senator, again, I'm David Voigt. I'm an assistant attorney general. The idea behind this bill is that by ensuring that schools have a policy in the first place, they can start to get the rules in place, and they can start to communicate with kids and parents in the schools to try to address the problem. The bill is not intended to dictate anything specific, because the idea is that the individual school boards are probably in a better position to determine what specific policies are best for their districts. The idea behind this bill is to make sure that each and every school district is at least takes that first step in addressing the issue of cyberbullying in their existing bullying policy.
Senator Hinn.
Thank you, Mr.
Followed
Chairman.
By Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Mouan and the witnesses. I'm troubled a little bit by this. I think, as I understand it, typically in the past we've tried to get school districts to focus on managing behavior in the school. And I think, frankly, we need to do a better job of that. But what this seems to suggest is that we should be managing behaviors that occur outside of the school, maybe not even during the school day. And I'm wondering, does that mean that if you have a group of kids over on a Saturday night at your house and they start making fun of somebody else, do we need to report that? And is that bullying? Or if they make some kind of politically incorrect statement about some other student? I think this is a severe overreach in terms of policy. If the intent isn't to do anything, if it doesn't have any enforcement behind it, it raises the question of why do this. And what I fear is that this is a distraction from the effort of how do you manage the activities of kids in the school. Can we successfully prevent them from using cell phones in the school or other kinds of electronic devices? Can we keep them off the internet in the school? We have trouble with those sorts of things. I'm concerned that if we don't focus on managing the behavior where we actually have control, why do we think we're going to be able to do this outside, at home, on weekends? And what about all the other non-cyber behavior that could happen in those environments? Are we going to be managing that as well? I'm confused. This is a little bit strange to me.
Well, Senator, if I might, one of the things that happens in the Code of Conduct for the St. Paul Public Schools, is that it is silent on the issue of this most recent phenomenon, and it's perhaps thought of by some parties that it's fair game, and anything that happens there isn't, in fact, something which should be the domain of the school. And yet all these things that happen have potential to, as I mentioned earlier, rear their ugly head as we have the students gather again on Monday morning. And for as much as there is the cloak of anonymity that is part of what happens in the bullying and the indelicacies that are visited upon each other, students have a sense of who the authors are. And sometimes they seek to have confrontational behaviors to redress those grievances they have. And it causes a significant problem for us. And I think it needs to be made mention of in a statement of about policy for a school district to have this be an arena that we can address.
Senator Olsen, followed by Senator Torres-Ray, then we're going to ask the School Boards Association to testify, and we also have another witness that Senator Saltzman asked to appear.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator.
Thank you. Like many of the fellow senators at this table, I too was once a school board member, and I can see where it'd be, you know, within this policy, you know, there could be a punishment of suspension or expulsion or something like that. My question is, something that they might discover may raise to a level of a higher crime. And I remember when we set a speed limit on our school parking lot, we had to have it be a city policy because the police couldn't enforce a school board policy. So they it was actually a law in the city. So my question goes to, if something was a crime that was higher than, you know, the warrant of a beyond a school board policy, how would law enforcement be able to work in this arena?
Mr. Backstrom.
Mr. Chair, Senator, we work very closely with our schools, with our law enforcement community. Many of the schools, especially the middle schools and high schools, have school liaison officers that are there to monitor issues that come up, and when a crime does occur, they're very quick to refer that to the county attorney for prosecution. Last year alone in Dakota County, we had 19 cases that we've charged felony terroristic threats incidents arising out of school-related conduct. A number of those included the preparation of hit lists and threats to the safety of other children and teachers in the school's complex. We take those cases very seriously. We're quick to follow through and file charges when a crime has occurred, and I encourage our school districts to do that. I also, by the way, encourage them, when they refer a case to me for prosecution involving bullying-related behavior, I want to have a little bit of a history behind the offense. I want to know who the bully was, because oftentimes we get the mutual fights in hallways, but many times they stem from one person tormenting another for many, many months. And it results in a fight. And, well, you know, we can't condone the behavior and hitting each other by anyone. We certainly want to know who was the main perpetrator behind that, so we can, you know, escalate the level of penalty associated with that offense. And we try to do that in our community, and I think it's a good policy to do that.
Thank you.
Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just would like to commend your work, Senator Mua, and the work that you are doing with the Attorney General's office. I think this is very important. I have noticed with my own children that the form of communication that they use with their friends now is only the internet, and MySpace is becoming the only way children relate. And that's the way they send messages to each other. This is the way they make friends or enemies, is through the internet. And the next day in the school, they have significant problems as a result of the messages that they send to each other throughout the day. It has become the norm. This communication through internet is the norm in the schools today. Children no longer call each other over the phone. Children are not inviting each other to their homes anymore. They are typing day and night messages to each other. And that's the way it is. Is not, I don't know what we can do to change. I personally try very hard to call friends to our house and invite children to the park and take them, but this is the form of communication, and I believe that we need to pay attention and give the opportunity to the districts to develop policies to address it. And I agree with you, Senator, that we need to give them some flexibility because it's not the same for everyone. You can't children interact in different ways with this. Depending on age, they're starting so young. Kindergartners are now sending messages to each other. It's not the same to address policy for a first grader than it is for a high schooler. It's just not the same. So we have to provide the flexibility to the schools to design their own policy. So I really appreciate that you're doing this.
Thank you to the panelists, and if you could be on standby for further recall, we would appreciate that. We'd like the School Boards Association to address the subject, and then Senator Saltzman has a witness as well to talk about a potential expansion on the bill. Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Tom Deans. I'm legal counsel of the School Board Association. We have a handout.
Yep, it'll be retrieved soon.
Mr. Chair, during the 2004-2005 biennium, we worked hard on the adoption of a bullying bill. We believe this is an important bill, an important issue as well. What we didn't want was something that was terribly prescriptive, something that allowed the school boards, who are the policymakers at that level, to be able to address this in the best way possible. However, the Minnesota School Board Association has a policy service. They provide model policies for any mandatory policy that the legislature passes. What's being passed out to you is that model policy. That's been adopted, some policy has been adopted by every school district, or we believe it's been adopted by every school district, since it was mandatory that they have one in place by, I believe, January 1, 2006. I think in many places they adopted this policy or something pretty similar to it. In other ones, they took whatever they had and they adjusted that. I can go through a number of items that are in that policy, but and perhaps we will a little later in response to some other amendments or whatever. But I would like to, if you look at the general statement of policy on the first page. If I can just sort of read that part for the record, it says that an act of bullying by either an individual student or a group of students is expressly prohibited on school district property or at school-related functions. This policy applies not only to students who directly engage in an act of bullying, but also to students who, by their indirect behavior, condone or support another student's act of bullying. This policy also applies to any student whose conduct at any time or in any place constitutes bullying that interferes with or obstructs the mission or operations of the school district or the safety or welfare of the student, other students, or employers. The misuse of technology, including but not limited to teasing, intimidating, defaming, threatening, or terrorizing another student, teacher, administrator, volunteer, contractor, or other employee of the school district by sending or posting email messages, instant messages, text messages, digital pictures or images, or website postings, including blogs, may also constitute an act of bullying, regardless of whether such acts are committed on or off school property and or with or without the use of school district resources. And as you go through the policy, you'll see that it's got reporting procedures and penalty procedures for both students and for staff. If they're doing the bullying or if there's a report made to them and they don't follow through, that's also covered. Moreover, in the internet, we're required to have an internet policy too, and it lists a whole bunch of things that you can't do on the internet at school. Now, I didn't give you a copy of that, but that policy provides that a student or employee engaging in any of the foregoing unacceptable uses of the internet when off school district premises and without the use of the school district system also may be in violation of this policy as well as other school district policies. In situations where the school district receives a report of an unacceptable use originating from a non-school computer or resource, the school district shall investigate such reports to the best of its ability. Students or employees may be subject to disciplinary action for such conduct, including but not limited to suspension or cancellation of the use or access to the school district computer system and the internet, and discipline under other appropriate school district policies, including suspension, expulsion, exclusion, or termination of employment. So we take this seriously. We have intervention provisions that are in there, but we have real consequences. One of the questions was as well, you know, why would they, what do the kids care? Well, the kids care. This gets put in the student handbook in that. They know if they do this, something bad is going to happen to them if they get caught. Now, as County Attorney Backstrom told you, sometimes the issues of proof here are hard, and especially when you're dealing with this cyber stuff, because you don't necessarily know where it came from, and it's some of those are hard. We're not going to necessarily get every one of them, but if we do find out who it is, this gives us the opportunity to move forward and to deal with this, and certainly to make the kids know that it's unacceptable behavior.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Deans, do you know how widely this policy has been adopted among school districts in Minnesota?
Ms. Chair, Senator Olson, I am not positive exactly how many districts have adopted this policy. We know that all districts are supposed to have a policy. This one was out there. They all had it to use as a model. We find many districts that belong to the policy service adopt these things with typos and all. Other ones, you know, have their own, and they do it their own way. But everybody has got something. Now, all of them may not have the cyberbullying piece of that. The cyberbullying stuff was added primarily to this policy in 2006, but it's been out there available for them since then. The only thing we would say is, you know, we've got 300 and some districts in theory that have adopted this, and the cyberbullying thing, I think, is a pretty quick fix. We don't want them all to have to go back and adopt an entire new policy if we can help it. Because we think that that we're on the road here. But that, you know, that's your call. But and then we can talk about enforcement things. There are potential enforcement problems with cyberbullying, which the Attorney General's office and that can tell you too. There have been court decisions that say sort of the issue that Senator Hand raised, that things that go on at home don't have anything to do with school, but that's why we've tied it in this policy, that if it affects the mission of the school or it affects the safety of the kids, as Peter Christensen said, they show up on Monday and they've been getting these emails and they've been getting this stuff all weekend, and then they want to have it out in the hall. Well, that affects the school.
Ms. Schwab, did you have just my...
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know the answer to this, but you often hear of the children being reluctant in a lot of circumstances, being intimidated about reporting or telling of what their experience has, and some may carry it to their death premature or in old age. How does one get around that? Because in this kind of a situation, when it's very personal, and it may not, unless there's some overt willingness, it's really hard to do. And that seems to be a fairly, at least to my observation, a fairly common behavior, is to internalize it and not tell anybody.
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson. That is exactly why this bill is so critical. And it is more so to not only alert parents and school districts, but to really bring a heightened level of awareness among the staff and the administrators in the school buildings where the students are in. We are in the midst of a cultural revolution. And our school buildings and our school administrators and our school policies need to catch up to that. And what we need to be prepared to do is to be able to explicitly put in place and bring along our teachers to continue to reinforce and send the message that it is okay for you when you receive a threatening email over the weekend, that it is okay for you to go to a grown-up at your school and disclose the information to them and let them try to help you address that. We're trying to put in place, I hope, an opportunity for school buildings, for site councils, for principals to rethink how to acculturate their school buildings and the grown-ups who watch over our children to become an access point so that the activities that our children engage in, the children can then feel like they can go to a grown-up or to a resource to be able to share some of the things that are happening in their lives that we don't know about. This is just good public policy, not just for cyberbullying, but for any other areas that we're concerned about, whether it's, you know, abuse or, I mean, just any other areas in our children's lives.
Senator Olson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman. Well, we already have the law that requires them to have the written policy, and you're extending that to cover the cyber aspect. And it would appear to me from just the quick review of the board's model policy that any district that has adopted your model policy would meet intent of what Senator Moore is attempting to do with this expanded language in that policy. So the only ones that it would provide some challenge to are those who may have to, who haven't adopted yours, that may have to modify their policy or adopt the board policy in order to do so. Is that an accurate assessment?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I believe that is an accurate assessment. I guess the part that is important is they have language here that they could utilize to incorporate into their policies, and it's on the MSBA website where they show these. That new language from 2006 would still be shown as shaded, so they would know what to adopt, or if they talk to the staff person, they wouldn't have to start over again, or at least in theory wouldn't have to start over again on their policy.
Thank you.
If I could offer, I believe the MSBA should be commended for a comprehensive policy. However, Senator Moore is making the point that state statute does not have the cyberbullying in it. For those districts that don't want to act, there is not a consequence, and we are state policymakers, so that may be the intent. We do have a letter from PACER, the Parent Advocacy Coalition for Educational Rights, in support of the legislation as well, and make sure we have that. And we have Senator Saltzman has someone that would like to address us very briefly, and then we would like to act on the bill or any possible amendment. Senator Saltzman.
Yes, and thank you, Mr. Chair. I would, though, like to move before Mr. David St. Germain comes up an amendment so that the members might be able to see what I am proposing with this.
Senator Saltzman, perhaps as a co-author of Senator Moore's bill, Senator Saltzman moves that Senate File 646 be recommended to pass and referred to the floor. Senator Saltzman.
Absolutely, yes. I was just about to note that I am a co-author on this bill. I commend Senator Moore and the Attorney General for doing this. The piece that is an amendment coming out, and do we have copies of that being distributed? Is to take much of the discussion that we've had about the MSBA model policy. And if you look in statute right now, if this bill passes, there will be two sentences. And while we've talked a lot about parental involvement involving parents, communication between schools and parents so that parents are aware of what's happening, there is nothing in statute right now that will require that with this policy. So I would like to ask Mr. Germain if he would come forward. And there's a group of people who are not here today. And they are the children in our schools who are the victims of bullying. And Tom Heffelfinger was here on Monday. We had a long discussion about school safety. And I listened to him as he spoke because he said something that really made me remember why I wanted to work on this legislation, is that victims of bullying have the highest risk of becoming our school shooters. And so if we're not involving parents in this discussion about what is happening, We need to do that. Now, why I have this amendment is I'm in the process of drafting
Senator Saltzman,
the bill.
Is it the A1 or A3 amendment?
I believe it's the A1 amendment. Yes, the A1 amendment.
Okay, Senator Saltzman offers the A1.
And I'm in the process of drafting this bill with Mr. Germain and some other people, so I wanted it to be part of this discussion today.
Proceed. Welcome. Please identify yourself and highlight your testimony.
Thank you. My name is David St. Germain. I've taught for 33 years in a suburban school district. And during that period of time, I was a classroom teacher, and for the last 15 years of my career, I split my time between professional development and teaching. And I found during that period of time, when I took the job as professional development coordinator, I thought people were going to be asking me to help them with their teaching, to help them with curriculum, and to observe them. They never asked for that. The number one problem in American schools is bullying. It's an epidemic, and it's stopping learning. Kids feel unsafe going to school. Teachers feel unsafe going to school. Bullying is rampant, and you can't learn if you're frightened. In the period of time I was at Chaska, I was a local and national union leader, and I've been a teacher trainer training teachers how to create a safe environment and a culture in a school and in a classroom. This afternoon, talking about this cyberbullying, it's fascinating to me because cyberbullying takes the problem. We're really talking about the problem of bullying here. Cyberbullying is just a magnification of that problem. And Lord, it is an unbelievable magnification of that problem. Before, if you wanted to do something nasty to a person, you started a rumor in the school, and it took days, weeks, and some kids never heard it. Bang. Overnight, you're gay. Overnight, you're a prostitute. This is what happens. And it is an unbelievable problem in American schools. And the policy that you have, I'm a practitioner. I'm a guy, I'm in the trenches. I understand what this is all about. I taught, I love kids. It's what got me up in the morning. And let me tell you, when a black kid comes to you and says, they called me the N-word, what am I supposed to do? And in my school district, we had no bullying problems. We had no race problems until kids came forward. What do you tell them? When you've got 1% or 2% of your population that's kids of color, and racial slurs happen, what do you tell them? They turn around and 30 kids are standing there. What are they going to do, have an investigation? So we need these laws from the state to help us. I just got off the phone this morning with one of the school districts I'm working with, talking with the technology coordinator. He brought this up. He said, I'm emailing all kinds of cyber stuff to the superintendent and to the school board, and nobody's acting on it. And he said, I don't know what to do. I'm paralyzed by this. And just because we have a policy doesn't mean anything is going to happen. We all know that, and that's what I've been hearing today. You just throw it over the wall. That doesn't mean that we're going to stop cyberbullying. We've got to stop the core issue, which is bullying, by making it a safe school. The Vermont law is what I'm here to talk about. The Vermont law was started by a father whose child was bullied and he committed suicide. And you may have seen it. It was on Primetime Live. It's been
Excuse
all over the
Mr.
place.
Mr. St. Germain, does the amendment address the Vermont law?
The amendment is the Vermont law.
Okay.
And the wonderful thing about the Vermont law, Senator, is it's simple. It's a very simple law. It doesn't take a lot of context to talk about this. Let me share with you what I see as the problem. The problem is threefold. When we talk about bullying and harmful behaviors in a school, we're talking about ignorance. People can't define what bullying is. I'm going to show you a video. A lot of you don't know what bullying is. Kids don't know what bullying
is. Let's watch the video. I believe it's 4 minutes.
Yes.
Okay. We're on a real tight time crunch.
Sure.
I think the record shows we are convinced it's a problem, and we'll get Senator Moaz's reaction. So we don't need but too much more persuasion that it is a problem, but we look forward to the video now.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Torres-Ray.
If I make a comment, I hate to use more of your time because we have two more bills that we need to hear. I will defer to the author, but I have a question about this amendment. I think this presents a tremendous problem for implementation. You're talking about requiring written reports, providing parents with a report, and could you imagine what that means for a school district like my district in the District of Minneapolis, where the district has to meet the needs of children that speak about, I don't remember, 125 languages? How can a parent provide a written report? What are they supposed to do? The schools are going to have some funding to really do this. The original language gave the school some flexibility to deal with this. But
Senator Torres-Ray, we'll ask Senator Moi to respond. And I understand the projector is not working right now, but I believe Senator Saltzman wanted to intervene.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Senator Torres-Ray. My next amendment was going to be to ask to strike lines 1.24 through 1.26, which would require collecting data on reported incidents, which may have a fiscal note to it. But as to your comment about requiring parents to file, what this amendment would do is that currently there is no specific language that encourages parents to report suspected bullying. And so there is a way for parents, as a parent, if they want to be able to report, is there a way for them? And it doesn't have to be a written report. It could be amended. But what I'm trying to do in this amendment is to really put some teeth into this, because we're talking a lot today about parental involvement, involving parents, having discussions between parents and school, and yet we have nothing in this policy that says schools have to do that. So I'm trying to put a little bit more, and the school board model policy, in looking through many of these pieces that are here in items 1 through 9, are pretty much included in the model program by the school board association. We're just, instead of saying some schools, I think that Mr. Dean was asked how many schools have implemented this policy, and his comment was, I'm not positive. So if we believe that this is important, should we be looking at putting some more prescription into what these policies should be and that they need to be there?
Thank you. Senator Moi on the A1 amendment.
Mr. Chair and members, obviously I feel Senator Saltzman's passion for this area, and so we are not counter to one another in this effort. Her amendment doesn't really prescribe specifics with respect to cyberbullying, which is what my bill is talking about. Her amendment, though, puts prescriptions about bullying in general. My general sense is that I tend to not want to overprescribe to what local elected and the school teachers and principals are willing to do. In general, the reason why I've asked and worked with the Attorney General's office to keep the language general is that so that it's consistent with the already with current law with respect to bullying in general, is to keep it flexible. Of course, it's the will of the committee if that's the direction they want to go. But my preference is that to prescribe as little as possible and to give some flexibility to school buildings and school districts.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman. I appreciate Senator Saltzman's contrast with the school board policy, and I wonder if Mr. Deans has had a chance to review this and could identify whether there are any specific provisions that are not encompassed in your policy as you've amended it in 2006 that are being proposed in this amendment.
Mr. Deans.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, if you look on the left-hand side of that policy, you'll see a bunch of kind of chicken scratching that'll say like 1.4 and 1.5. Those are cross-references to where in Senator Saltzman's amendment what provisions are incorporated in here. I believe the only thing that is not covered in our policy that's covered in Senator Saltzman's amendment is that language on 1.24 to 1.26 that requires the district to collect the data and put it on its website. of every incident of bullying that happens during a year.
So Senator Olson.
So, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Salzman, your language is still related just to policy, and then the items that are addressed in it just detail largely what you do have in your model policy. And is your intent to attempt to get all districts to adopt the School Board Association policy versus do anything independently?
Yes. Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, yes. The attempt is to require this as opposed to, at this point, the content of the policy may or may not include all of these items.
Senator Moore.
Mr. Chair, members, might I also suggest that I know that Senator Saltzman's amendment deletes my new language, but I would think that to achieve what she wants, really she should just insert this into the bill, leaving in my language that covers cyberbullying. That way, bullying in general and cyberbullying, if her amendment does come in, I mean, they don't contradict each other. So if it's the will of the committee to be more prescriptive about bullying and bullying policy, I still would like my language on cyberbullying to be part of the statutes. Because if we were to drop out my language and put in this prescription, we have defeat the whole purpose of examining cyberbullying as an issue.
I'd like to get a response or a little more testimony from Mr. St. Germain, and then we could perhaps consummate on action in about 5 minutes. Mr. St. Germain.
I'd like to show the video.
And it's 4 minutes? Okay.
I think I'll just talk for a couple of seconds, if I could, please. The problem with bullying is that we have ignorance. People can't define what it is. And there's avoidance issue going on with teachers. You know, right now, bullying is handled by administrators and counselors. We need to broaden that so teachers are dealing with bullying on a day-to-day level, and it's part of their job. Administrators and teachers are not going to be able to continue to administrators and counselors are not going to be able to continue to do this. You know, right now there's a mentality that says by teachers and some teachers, it's not my job, no one told me to deal with this. That's why we need a law. We need someone to tell us that this is something that we need to be doing. It's somebody else's responsibility. The principal handles it. You know, this is going to go away. This too will pass. It's not a real problem. We have real problems in school, and that's not one of them. Everyone's watching you. We have retaliation, and what happens is that we have a retaliation. Kids are frightened to tell anybody because it's going to get worse. If you take that bully and you bring him into the office and you deal with it, but you're not involving the parents, this law is about parent involvement. This is what parents want to be involved with, their children. I want to know if my child has been bullied. I want to know if my child's a bully. I want to be able to intervene. You empower me as a parent by doing that, by having parent involvement. And that's what this law does. It's victims' notifications, bullies' notifications, and it's about intervention strategies. Those are the three things. And it's not mutually exclusive. It has nothing to do with cyberbullying and everything to do with cyberbullying.
Senator Salzman.
We seem to be having technical difficulties, yes. Mr. Chair, and I appreciate our time. And so I guess I would like to amend my amendment, if this is the correct, to eliminate lines 124 through 1.26.
Okay, and Senator Saltzman's motion. All in favor, indicate aye.
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 Opposed, no. We now have before us Senate File 646, A1 amendment with the deletion of 24 through 26.
Are you ready to vote, Senator Stump?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do lines 1.8 and 1.9 create, I know Senator Torres-Ray mentioned the written reports. How, I'm not sure exactly how that would be carried out. Maybe Senator Moore, in a large district, what?
Perhaps Senator Saltzman, it's her language, so.
Okay.
In the MSP, excuse me, Mr. Chair, and Senator Stump, in the MSBA language, it has some language that may, it says shall report. I'm trying to find it here. That people who are aware of acts of the of bullying will report. And I do not know if it's specific as to how that's done. I would be very open to just to make sure that there is a process in place that enables parents or guardians to report suspected bullying, that there is a way for them that enables them to do that.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Moore.
Mr. Chair and Senator Stumpf, I think that, again, as a parent who has a child in the public schools, you know, nowadays the schools all have systems to notify parents about a number of things that are going on in the schools. And I would hope that it would not be that difficult once the schools have built this into their system to pick up the phone and call the parents or to find a way to communicate with the parents that this is happening at the school. I don't think this is asking schools to go above and beyond what they're currently doing. I would think that there's already systems in place for the reporting to take place. That it is my hope that, you know, if schools do decide to develop the policies, that they would put something like this into their policies to communicate with parents.
Members, we have the amendment before us, and if it does not go on, there is still that opportunity to further discuss it between now and when it would be acted on the floor. So depending on outcome, it's not potentially lost. Senator Olsen, and then we'll vote.
Well, this is a new experience for me because this new 646 would not include Senator Moore's language. Is that correct?
Yes, Senator Olsen, Senator Moore's language would be included at 1.4, 1.5.
Okay. Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Senator Saltzman.
To clarify that, lines 1.4 and 1.5 do include the new language.
Mr. Chairman.
That's what I just said. Senator Olsen.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it essentially is a delete all amendment. It skirts that by just saying the policy shall and it only deleting one line of it. But nonetheless, it's a delete all amendment.
Yeah, this is a
bill.
Yes.
Is only a one sentence.
Yes, it's a one sentence bill and it's restated at 1.4 and 1.5. We are going to vote on the A1 amendment as amended. All in favor indicate aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion does not prevail. We now have Senate File 646.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to make a comment.
Senator
Torres-Ray. I just want you to know that this was a very important issue for me, and I wish that we have been able to vote on your proposal. I do agree with Senator Saltzman that we do need to address bullying, and I wish we had a different bill with language for that. But this was quite cumbersome for me to be able to vote for it, and I hope it comes back, to be honest. And I hope you come back with language that is
Senator Saltzman, I believe, will have another bill on this, Senator Torres-Ray. Senator Stumpf,
just a comment. I believe you're going to be bringing this back as a bill.
May.
Probably. Hopefully. One of the problems that I think is out there is that when bullying is reported, and in particular when there's a charge that's being made, and the county attorney investigates, at least in the districts that I know, that then becomes public information on the part of the person who is the victim, but not the perpetrator. And I think what needs to be done is we need to go in and amend the data privacy laws, either to make, if you're going to make the information available about the victim, then the perpetrator's information ought to be made available as well. Because quite often it's confusing out there when you see a report in a paper, you see the victim's name and not the perpetrator's. And that perpetrator can go on and create another bullying event next week, and his name never does appear in the paper or in any public report.
Mr. Chair and Senator Stumpf, I know the chair of the Judiciary Committee very well, and I will urge that the committee look at that.
Thank you.
Thank you, members. We now have Senate File 646, one sentence before us. And it would be recommended to go to the floor with the earlier advice that there's always the possibility of amendments later and other bill introductions. All in favor indicate aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion carried. Thank you, Senator
Moore,
and
Chair
witnesses.
And
we next have Senate Files 381 and 465. For 381 on Labor Day Start Repealer, we'll ask the proponents to speak for 10 minutes and opponents for up to 10 minutes. And since Senator Michelle's bill in 465 includes the repealer, we'll get that testimony since we have common witnesses. And following action on 381, if we get to that, hopefully by about a quarter after, we'll go to the balance of Senator Michelle's bill. Welcome, Senator Lynch. And I could highlight this is a bill that has been before the legislature before, and there's a couple of main arguments for and against, and we'll hear those and appreciate your work on this.
Thank you, Chair Wieger, members of the committee. I'm here today with Senate File 381, and we are here quite simply to discuss good public policy. The intent of this legislation is to give local districts the authority to determine their school calendar. This bill gives local elected school boards authority to make decisions after gathering input from their community, from their students, their staff, their stakeholders, that they feel best meets the needs of their district and their community. What works for one community might not work for another community. I have a series of distinguished guests with me today, and I think we'll begin with Kirk Schindwind with the Minnesota School Board Association.
Thank you, Senator Lynch. And again, we'll ask the proponents 10 minutes and allocate as you would like.
Mr. Chair, my name is Kirk Schindwind. I'm on staff of the Minnesota School Boards Association, and I want to thank you for taking this bill up today. And as you know, this bill is very simple, not a complicated bill, comes straight forward, straight at you. And what this does is give school boards a choice that many school board members believe that has long been overdue and been usurped by the state legislature. The choice is about selecting a school start date. We've heard story after story about how schools are the cornerstone or the anchor of a community, yet it appears that we aren't capable of making our own decisions on when to start school. How the governance of its school by local citizens through the school board is not only a way for the community members to give back to the community and school, but also an opportunity to provide leadership, structure, and support to improve student achievement and opportunities for their community students. This bill would allow leadership of the school boards to shine. If this bill becomes law, it would allow local school boards to seek the input from families in the community, business leaders, teachers, and administrators before deciding when to begin the school year. After gathering the necessary input, the decision, we believe, should be made in the school district boardroom. The needs and goals of the community of Halleck are not likely the same as Hayfield. And as many of you on this committee know, firsthand, from firsthand experience, setting up the school calendar is one of the most challenging events that you may have. A challenge that we believe that local school boards, locally elected school boards, and the school administration can certainly handle, not the state legislature. If the elected school board moves to start school on a day that does not meet the needs of its families and community members, we're quite confident that the ballot box will offer a certain course correction. The bill is about local control. A lot of discussion is given to local control, only to turn around again and again to see mandates that usurp the decision-making authority of local school boards. School board members are the ones who are closest to the action, who understand the pulse and the feel of the community, and never before have the accountability and the efforts to improve student achievement been so transparent. Limiting school board and district efforts in this establishment of a school start date limits their flexibility in their attempt to have an attempt to meet their students, meet the state standards or exceed the state standards. And I will turn it over to our distinguished gentleman to my left here, superintendents, to talk about the local impact from Rochester. Mr. Jerry Williams.
Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jerry Williams, and I'm honored to represent the Rochester Public Schools as its superintendent. We in the Rochester Public Schools strongly support this bill, Senate File 381, because it allows local school districts the local discretion to develop a school calendar that is in the best interest of their students. It allows local school districts greater flexibility to make occasional adjustments in their calendars to meet the instructional needs of students so that school can be dismissed at a reasonable time around Memorial Day, when the wear of a school year begins to show on everyone. The current designated start date is already somewhat shaky because of the significant numbers of students who are involved in school activities 2 to 3 weeks prior to Labor Day. Statewide, in just Minnesota State High School League athletic programs, there are tens of thousands of students involved. Consider these fall statistics for the 3 week period prior to Labor Day. In the fall of 2002, there were 83,007 students involved 2 to 3 weeks prior to Labor Day in Minnesota State High School League activities. In the fall of 2003, there were 80,745 students involved. In the fall of 2004, 80,878 students involved. In the fall of 2005, 79,634 students involved in the 2 to 3 week period prior to Labor Day. The statistics for the fall of 2006 are not yet available. And those don't include the marching bands that are practicing getting ready for the upcoming season, the thousands of students, thousands of PSEO students who are fully engaged in classes at higher education institutions, or the many private schools that began prior to Labor Day, including one in our community of Rochester. In our district alone, we have more than 2,800 students involved in band, athletics, PSEO, and a small elementary school on a 45-15 calendar that starts school the end of July. You expand the number to siblings and other family members, and there are a lot of people involved in school activities prior to Labor Day. And who hasn't experienced in a home the readiness of students to start school when those above activities have started? But in the end, it comes down to the desires of the local community through their elected representatives, the school board, to make the decision that not only best fits the needs of the community, but the students. It's for the benefit of the students in one of our choice elementary schools that we start in late July and end in mid-June with intermittent catch-up breaks during the school year. It's for the students and an appropriate end time to our calendar that we desire this local flexibility. Students are already well engaged in school-related activities prior to Labor Day, and I encourage you to support Senate File 381, which gives us the flexibility to set our own start date. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, if now we could go to Charlie Kite with the Minnesota Association of School Administrators.
Good afternoon. I'm Charlie Kite, Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. We're here to testify that MASA, our association, strongly supports this bill. I'll defer any other comments to a couple of people that we have down here with us. Tammy Uselman is the superintendent from Perham Dent. I think she drove about 175 miles to testify, so let's get her on.
Thank you and welcome.
176 and a half. My name is Tamara Uselman. I'm the superintendent from Perham Dent. I grew up on a farm. I live on a lake, and my son works at a resort.
And as such, I have a very deep respect for everyone who makes their living from the land. And because of that, I'd almost like to cower away from this issue rather than face it. Yet at the end of the day, and the beginning of each day, it's my profession to work hard for what's best for kids in the long run. The repeal of the after Labor Day start date for schools would allow school administrators, consisting of the school board and in-house administration, to work with the community to create a calendar that would work best for the district students and families. It's true in my area we have fewer farm families than we've ever had before, but don't mishear me. Ag is very viable in my part of the state. What I know about my farm families is that they will always put their kids' education first and foremost. It's true that by the second or third week of August, we have a very high percentage of our students back and involved in extracurricular activities. It's also true that by that time, I think it's fair to say most students are ready to return and eager to start school. And my final note would be that an earlier start date would help to reduce that summer slide in skills that we see when students return in the fall. We're held to a high standard of accountability. I like accountability. I really do. But we need to have the tools to make accountability work at the very local level. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I have just two more, and if you just bear with us for just a moment.
We appreciate it.
And next we have Elaine Skretner. How's that?
That's very good.
All right. And Elaine joins us as a teacher.
Senator, welcome. Members of the committee, I am Elaine Skretner. I teach in the Edina schools right now. I'm your person in the trenches. This is my 39th year in education, and I have always been in the trenches, a classroom teacher, either on special assignment or teaching kids. For me, when I look at this, I know how the expectations and demands of our schools have changed, and yet the school year and the school day have remained exactly the same. This piece of repealing the Labor Day start is simply local flexibility. It is probably the beginning of something. I won't deny that. But for districts like mine that offer enormous amounts of advanced placement courses, we watch schools in other states have 2 and 3 weeks jump on us in terms of teaching that material because the tests come in May from the College Board, regardless of when you start school. So there's that piece. I agree with Tamara on the backslide. And for schools that are on the block schedule, to be able to start earlier and perhaps finish their semester before a traditional winter break may make a great deal of sense in terms of long-term learning. So I also firmly support the bill.
Thank you, Ms. Gretner.
And Madam Chair, our last testifier today is Dr. Rick Dressen, superintendent from Edina.
Welcome, Dr. Dressen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee members, I too wish to support this file number. My perspective is many, a superintendent in Waconia, Minnesota, superintendent in Alexandria, Minnesota, now superintendent in Edina. I've been around, and the key is independence. The strength of Minnesota public schools remains the ability to be independent and the desire for each school district to maximize its resources, including time. You've heard a lot about the past. You've heard a lot about the current. I think we also need to be looking at the future. The future of education is going to be about looking at time differently, looking at time from a learning standpoint that is continuous, that needs to be looking at it from a year-round perspective and a timeless perspective. We cannot be caught in the current as we look to the future. Time is going to be one of our most valuable resources for our young people and their learning. They're ready to learn in different times. They're ready to learn in different places and different ways. I think this is a true restriction to minimize or to limit when we can start the learning with them. And I urge you to support this file.
Thank you, and thank you to the panel. We will hold questions until we hear from those who are here to testify on the other side of the question. And we will be limiting your testimony also to 10 minutes. And those who wish to speak on the other side of the question, please step forward.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I brought my bobber.
I like that.
Yeah. Yeah, members, my name is Joel Carlson.
Carlson. I own a legal research and government affairs business here in St. Paul, and I'm here on behalf of the Congress. You happen to pick a great day for us. Today is our day. Our day at the Capitol for the Congress. So thank you for hearing this bill today. You know, our bobbers say Minnesota Lakes is a family vacation on a good fishing lake. That is Minnesota. And when you talk about tourism in Minnesota and our lakes and our great outdoors, that is an experience that makes life in Minnesota a richly woven tapestry. And while it's true that resorts are in decline, we used to have over 3,000 resorts in Minnesota. We're now down to about 900. And it's true that resorts have issues with property taxes and rising property tax, rising value of lakeshore and regulation and zoning. You know, as my daughter tells me, we have issues. But we're not here to talk about that. What we're here to talk about is our support for quality education in Minnesota. To a person, the Congress of Minnesota Resorts supports your efforts to improve learning outcomes. We're not here to pit learning outcomes against resort economics. You know, we know that you're looking at a number of reforms to improve learning in Minnesota. All day, every day kindergarten, longer school days, more adding school days to the calendar. You know, there are a number of things that you're looking at to improve education in Minnesota. And what we would ask in your job as state representative or state senators, I'm house trained, sorry, the post-Labor Day school start time passed when I was in the House in 1985, so I've been around this issue a long time. But as you look at your job as state senators, that you balance all the interests of the state and that you look at improvements that balance all the interests in the state, Madam Chairman, and we believe that a number of reforms that you can act on do not conflict with Minnesota's tradition of summer and can improve learning outcomes. You know, one of the proudest things I've ever worked on here with Senator Sams is restating the post-Labor Day school start time in 2005. It was a proud moment for him and a proud moment for me, and we'd like to see it stay because we think that it is not inconsistent with your job. I have two school board members I'd like to introduce to you, Madam Chair, and have them comment as well. Thank you for hearing us.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson.
My name is Dave Keller. I own Brookside Resort in Park Rapids, Minnesota. I served 10 years on the Park Rapids School Board. I also served on Governor Pawlenty's Grad Standards Committee. Madam Chair, members, education obviously is important to me. Good public education is a priority for most Minnesotans. My testimony today is not about resort economics. That's not what this committee does. It's about good education. Quality in the classrooms, outcome we can be proud of. There are many reforms and initiatives proposed for education, like Joel has mentioned. These seem to be the most common that we hear about. None of these targeted educational outcomes have anything to do with a post-Labor Day school start. These targeted outcomes can all be achieved with additional funding, dedicated educators, and within the parameters of our existing school calendar boundaries. Currently, there are many schools that really don't use the entire days they have now, dismissing classes before mid-afternoon. While serving on the Park Rapids School Board, I went through the process of calendar setting every year. Anyone who looks at the school calendar can see much room for changes within existing schedules of breaks, vacations, and other days off. As legislators, you have the responsibility to look out for the interests of all people of Minnesota. Sometimes, when left to themselves, decisions one group makes can greatly affect other groups. Post-Labor Day school start has a great and wonderful effect on families, on students, on tourism, including the state fair. If starting school before Labor Day would achieve all the desired educational outcomes that are proposed, we would be all for it. It'd be great, but it won't. The proposed educational reforms can all be achieved without disrupting the system we once again have put into place for our school starting date. I'd ask that you not support once again changing this system, as it really does nothing to aid in achieving the improvements in education that Minnesotans want to see. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Keller. And I saw you editing in your as you went along. I appreciate it. Our next speaker is?
Madam Chair, my name is Ed Becker, and I'm from the Nevis School District, and I wish I had a well-prepared speech, as these guys do. But in the interest of time, I would like to just say that everything that these gentlemen have said is also my point of view. I am a current school board member. I don't know if I mentioned that. Fairly new at it, but new enough to know that we are mandated many of things, and many of those mandates are set up off of decisions that you at the Capitol here make every year. And it is a fine balance of what the state is. I have traveled throughout the state. I've got relatives all over the place. I've been to many school board association annual meetings and so forth, met with a lot of constituents on the school boards. And I don't run into a lot of them that are saying, hey, we want the freedom to do this. They all understand that we work together and that it has to be a balance. There are a few out there that do believe that, you know, there should be local control. Others, it really doesn't matter. So I'd ask that you would please keep that in mind that and not support this bill, because I believe that I think it's a mixed batch of people out there that believe it should start prior to Labor Day.
Thank you, Mr. Becker. Mr. Anderson.
Yes, I'll be very brief. Madam Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity today. For the record, my name is Howard Anderson. I'm the president of the Minnesota Lodging Association this year. I'm here today on behalf of Hospitality Minnesota, who represents 2,400 tourism-related businesses with the Minnesota Restaurant Association, Minnesota Lodging Association, and the Resort and Campground Association. It's important for us to point out that we are in support of all efforts to improve education in our state, and we're well aware of the importance of having a highly educated workforce. In the same regard, we also recognize that having schools start their year after Labor Day is one of the most important pieces of one of the higher impact pieces coming to the forefront this year. Businesses throughout the state have experienced a negative downturn of business prior to the reinstatement of the post-Labor Day start in 2005, and representing 242,000 jobs and $3.4 billion in wages, it does have an impact on the entire state. And we echo the same, all of the information from these gentlemen to our right. So, again, thank you very much for allowing the time, and I'll cut my points short.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson, and our appreciation goes to all of you who came such a long distance to testify today. In the interest of time, what I'm going to ask is if Senator Lynch wants to move her bill, and then if we will have a brief discussion. We believe most people probably already know where they're going to be.
Madam Chair, noting that this bill has no appropriation, I move that Senate File 381 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to finance.
Is there any discussion? Seeing no discussion, we'll take a voice vote. Those in favor of the bill, Senate File 381, say aye.
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 Those opposed? The bill passes. Thank you, gentlemen.
Next, Senator Michelle, Senate File 465, and many of your witnesses are here.
I don't know. I think it's more restraining.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is the bill that guarantees me grief when I go home to my four daughters every night. But let me tell you what it is not. This is not necessarily a longer school year bill. again, echoing some of the conversation and discussion and testimony that we just had with Senator Lynch's bill, this would give more control back to school boards as to how they set up their school calendar. What this bill does would it would mandate a minimum number of days in school. But let me give you a few numbers at the outset here before we get some testimony. Minnesota is the only state that does not mandate a minimum number of days in school, of days in the classroom, of instructional time. Our average days in school classrooms is about 172 days, about 172. If you look at the average of the 49 other states, it's about 180 days. So that means we're in class a little less than 2 weeks of what the average is in the nation. As we all know, it's not the 1950s anymore. We have this competitive global economy, and we don't just want our students to beat Iowa, and we don't just want to beat Wisconsin, but we have to look overseas. Let me give you some more numbers. China, they're in the classroom 230 days a year. Japan and Australia, 210. England, 190. So, again, what this bill would do is mandate 180 days. And then we would leave it to the school boards that many of you have sat on, to the superintendents, some of them are with us today, to the teachers and the parents to come up with the appropriate school calendar for that school district. It may be different. It may be different for an outstate district. It may be different for a suburban district. So I appreciate the committee's time and attention. I wish we had, of course, a little more time today. But let me turn it over first to Mr. Kite.
Welcome, Mr. Kite.
Charlie Kite, Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. A handout went around the table. It's called the Minnesota Promise. It's a vision for world-class schools. It was developed by about 25 of or are considered to be very strong superintendents in the state. And you'll note in there that one of the eight traits talks about time in school. We see our future here in Minnesota directly linked to providing our children with top-notch educations. And it is more important than ever to have our children in school. Today we'll have three people testifying. We are going to start with Dr. Chris Richardson of Northfield, and then Lonnie Scretner of Edina and Tammy Usselman of Perham. You've heard from them each before. I would just note that we didn't realize this when we invited these people to testify, but both Tammy Usselman and Lonnie Scretner are both Krista McAuliffe scholars and recognizes some of the top educators in the state, and they were reunited when they came here today. So we'll start by asking Dr. Richardson to speak.
Welcome,
yes,
Dr.
Madam
Richardson.
Chair and members of the committee. Again, my name is Dr. Chris Richardson. I'm superintendent of the Northfield Public Schools. Been an educator for 36 years. I'm in my 26th year as a school superintendent, and I've been in districts from 220 kids K-12 to 22,000 kids K-12. I was also very fortunate to be one of those 25 superintendents involved in the development of Minnesota's Promise, and very much appreciate the opportunity to speak today. I think we're at a really exciting time in education right now because I think we're really seeing the convergence of several things. First, powerful assessment tools, really driven by the entire national movement. Staff development strategies that really focus on creating professional learning communities. At the same time, I think we're seeing a lot of research coming down in terms of the positive impact of increased student time on task, but that time on task needs to be with highly qualified instructors. And I think we're seeing all of those things now coming together, the data, practice, and research. And I believe that that gives us the opportunity to do something we probably have never been able to do in terms of really seeing data drive staff development drive quality instruction, and if we can have increased instructional time, we can really make a difference in terms of student achievement. I think at the same time as we see the convergence of these pieces, we're also facing three major challenges. First, I think we're operating one of the shortest calendars in the country, and again, we've talked a little bit about that already this afternoon. Again, with 172 average days in comparison to upwards of 230 across the world, it's a very different situation for us in terms of world competition. I think over the last few years, we've also looked at the fact that we've had a significant amount of state and nationally mandated assessments added to our plate. Most school districts would tell you right now it's four or five more days of assessment than we had 10 years ago, and yet our number of days is exactly the same. And while the testing, I think, is vital for helping us understand where kids are and what they need, it really further reduces what's already one of the shortest calendars in the industrialized world. I think that shortness of calendars also impacted by arbitrariness in terms of start dates, end dates, anything else where we deal with that situation. I think second, the average calendar for teachers in terms of their contract year, typically about 186 or 187 days for teachers, provides very limited opportunities for non-student contact days for training and working in professional learning communities. Once we get done with grade reporting and conference days, there's usually just a very few days to address that piece. And again, research says that if we can work with teacher training and really have collaborative work happening there, the training can combine the assessment data and best practice, that we can go through a cycle where we really support teachers in making a significant difference in terms of how students learn. So for me, my sense is with the few days of staff development we have in the current contract years, teachers can't make effective use of the data or create and practice new teaching strategies based on what they've learned. I believe the initial solution to these issues is to really think about the increase in the school calendar to a minimum of 180 days and the teacher contract to a minimum of 200 days while eliminating the arbitrary Labor Day start. While passage of this bill still doesn't bring us to the level of world-class instruction as we've heard about today or what we've envisioned in Minnesota's promise, I think it really takes a good first step. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Richardson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, my name is Tamara Uzelman, and the superintendent in Perham Dent. I think the first question that you have to ask when we talk about lengthening the school year is the one your daughters would ask, and that is, why this horrid idea? And although I'm a superintendent now, I wasn't always. I was actually a geography teacher at one time. So I'm going to ask you to do a little mental mapping with me. If you in your mind draw a line from Japan to Northern Australia to India and across China back to Japan, we have what we would call, I believe, the Asian Triangle. And that is where most of the world's people will live and most of the world's commerce will take place within most of our lifetimes. Now, if China has 230 days of school and my school district has 175, that means by the time my kids graduate, my students graduate, an equivalent education in China actually has 3.5 to 4 more years of education before we ever talk about college. The other thing I would like this group to think about is that our students simply have to compete with students from the Asian Triangle for quality employment in their lifetime because they're going to be competing in a global marketplace. It was mentioned that staff development for teachers to get them retrained and retooled as we move through new technology will take time, and the National Council for Staff Development talks about continuous, sustained staff development. A longer school year would allow for that, certainly. And I guess my final note, I would say, I was asked by a student, would you like to have gone to school longer? And my answer to that is really simple. I can't prepare these students for my past. They need to be prepared for their futures. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Uselman.
That's a good one.
And once again, Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Lonnie Screntner, and I teach AP U.S. History and serve as the gifted resource teacher at Edina High School. In my 39 years, I've taught 16 years of middle school and the rest in senior high. I've spent some time on special assignment, working, mentoring new teachers, so my concept of staff development changed when I did that, and working on curriculum. My basic message is that current and future education cannot be met by a calendar that was designed for an agricultural society. And that is, as a historian, that is what we still have. In my 39 years, the amount that students have had to learn has increased. The time on task has not. The demands for accountability, as Superintendent Richardson said, 5 to 10 days out of the same calendar that we spend testing, each one of those days is a day where a student is not learning. They are simply being assessed. Both of those items demand more highly qualified teachers. That takes staff development and collegial time working together, not just writing curriculum, not just doing parent conferencing, not just doing grades. How do we do this? Flexibility has to be the key, as everybody has said. Local control, I think, here in Minnesota has proven successful. Even with our shortened calendar, we still have pretty good test scores. We don't look so bad, and we can pat ourselves on the back and say, oh, we can just keep doing that. But everybody else is going to catch up to us and pass us unless we begin to make some changes, which means operating funds, it means capital funds, it means a big kind of commitment on the part of this state. But as Tamara said, if we want to compete in that global economy, that's what we have to do. And so although as a teacher, you know, the people who say teachers became teachers because they get their summers off, number one, we don't really. It's when we write curriculum and take the collegial time that we don't get during the year. But sure, I love summer, but I also want my nation and my state to continue to compete on the global level. So I support this wholeheartedly.
Thank you to all of you. Did you have additional comments, Mr. Kite? Thank you. Mr. Carlson and Mr. Keller, did you want to make comments?
Probably just leave the bobber down this time. Madam Chairman and members, after that impressive display on that first bill, I think maybe I should change tactics and support Senator Michelle's bill. That might advance it a little quicker. We support what you're doing to improve education. We want you to know that. And as you do that, we want you to balance all the interests in the state. And if more time on task is what is needed, you know, we encourage you to do that. We just don't think that the second part of his bill needs to happen as you go about adding days to the school calendar. I think we'd leave our comments at that, Madam Chair. Happy to answer any questions and appreciate your time. We know it's a difficult issue. Thank you.
Senator Stump.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, it might have been for some of the testifiers before, but we do have in statute a flexible learning year, and I'm just wondering why school districts don't buy into that, because you can have school year-round if you want, and then you're not hampered by the start school after Labor Day, and you can have 240 days of school if you want that. And that's maybe not a question that you have to answer. It seems to me that the struggles that we're dealing with right now in our education system aren't necessarily lengthening the school year. I think, first of all, I think we should be paying our bills. when you look at the $500-600 million in special education cross subsidy, and you look at the huge need for early childhood and all day kindergarten, and I think to a large extent it's a resource issue that we're really in a crunch right now. I think that we can make strides, and I know Senator Saltzman and many others, Senator Rummel, are working on ways to take the money that we use for staff development right now, which is 2%, and use it in a more effective way across our school districts for teacher training. I think that's maybe close to about $200 million across the state. the other concern I have is that not necessarily adding on programs is actually good in terms of, You know, the governor came out and talked about 4 years of a foreign language. 4 years of a foreign language is fine if that's what that individual student and parents want. But if that means that that student cannot participate in some other program like applied learning, then it's not good. We ran that course under the profiles of learning where we had students' agendas so defined that an individual student that wanted to go down a science path for medicine or some other path couldn't do it because they had to comply with all these other requirements. So more of the same is not necessarily good. I think we need to reexamine our education system in a more ground or internal way, and be sure that we stress the academics, we stress the technology, and we also stress the applied learning. And the applied learning is where we're really hurting. We can have lots of very smart kids in chemistry and math, but how that is applied in our everyday world is something that I think we really need to look at in our education system. So I'm not supporting this bill. I think we do have flexibility with the flexible learning year. I think that we need to do a more internal look in changing our education system to make it more effective.
Madam Chair.
Senator.
Just not in response, but to continue the conversation with Senator Stumpf, I agree with much of what he said. This is a resource question, and ultimately we will have to weigh this versus all the other activities, programs, and priorities that we're talking about. But it does strike me from the testimony of the superintendents and the teachers and others that maybe the way we've done it for the last 50 years doesn't necessarily make sense going forward. So although I'm certainly nervous after Senator Stumpf's declaration of his views on this bill, I do think the appropriate place for this bill is his division, his budget division, so that we can then have that discussion about resources and priorities. So, Madam Chair, I would move that that we recommend this bill for passage and refer it to the Education Budget Division.
Is there,
Madam Chair, it would be the correct motion would be to the Committee on Finance.
To the Committee on the Education.
Thank you, Senator Stumpf.
On Finance.
His place.
Senator Chahan and Senator Saltzman.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And I just a question, Senator Michelle, or maybe one of your witnesses. The current number of non-instructional days that we have, do we know what that is? Your bill is asking for an increase in the calendar and an increase, or at least 20 non-instructional. How does that compare to the current number of non-instructional days?
Senator Han and members of the committee, actually right now many school districts have a total work year of 185 days and then about 170, I'll just say 173, it's a little variability there, for student time. Therefore, the non-instructional days are about a dozen days.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kite. Senator Saltzman.
Excuse me, Madam Chair, and Senator, I would love to be able to compete with other countries, but I look at this and it feels like an unfunded mandate to me. And that's what I'm concerned about. And I guess I'd like to hear from the school board how they feel about this, because I think that for us to be able to tell schools, because in the schools in my district, if this was to be implemented as it is, I can't imagine the staff cuts that we would be doing. I think it was about 10 years ago where we asked school districts to add 3 days to the calendar. So I think to look at this by itself, it's a wonderful cause. I would love to be able to say I'm supporting a longer school year, but the way we support a longer school year is by voting for investments in education and looking beyond Right now, what do we have? About $35 million beyond what we had last time around in the last biennium, and that's not going to buy 15 days. So I think we need to look at this in terms of finance, and if that's where we want to put priorities, is to buy in 15 more days. But a noble cause that I think we should see as a long-term vision. So does the school board have a position on this?
Madam Chair, Senator Saltzman, did you mean school board or
association?
School
I'm sorry, school board association, because they're okay. The ones who set the budgets.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair and Senator Saltzman, I think it's an issue that
for the record, your name.
Oh, pardon me. My name is Kirk Stein, and I'm on staff with the school boards association. I think it's an issue, as they've talked a little bit about, is resources for this one in terms of that, and I think that. We don't have, as an association, you know, we have a very grassroots-oriented group who get together every December and vote on issues. And they have not established a position on extending days or time for the school year. They do, as we've talked about, is have a position that's established about the school start date and local flexibility on that provision. So.
Thank you. Senator Erickson-Rose.
Madam Chair, if I could in response to Senator Saltzman's point, because I think it's important. Local control and no more unfunded mandates. I bet everyone at this at that table has said it, and we believe it. I certainly believe it. We should not do this. We should not do this unless the state is going to fund it. So I don't think I can be any more clear on that, and that's why I think again, the next step for this bill is to have that resource cost discussion at the budget level, as opposed to the policy committee.
Thank you. Now, Sister Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was going to just talk about the same thing as Senator Saltzman brought up, and Senator, you perhaps just answered my question very plainly right here now. Then. About funding that, because I think all of us were told by our constituents when it came up here, no more unfunded mandates. So my question to Senator Michelle, though, is do you have an idea about what the cost for this additional extension would be? I'm not opposed to lengthening the school year. I think there's many aspects of reform that we need to look at. In addition to the cost question, looks like Mr. Kite's poning up to the mic for that one. But I'm also concerned that if we decide to make a decision like this at the legislative level, that besides the folks you brought in for testifying, Senator, we should also hear very clearly from parents and from teachers and then the students. I'm a big one for bringing all the voices to the table. And when I listen to some of your folks testifying here, you know, I'm always wondering about whose voices are not being heard. So I'd particularly be interested in what the teachers think about it. If they have there's Ms. Salzwager, wondering if they have a position as well.
And members, as Ms. Salzwager approaches, for those of you going to the site visit at Borough School, that starts at 6:30, so we can probably go about 5 to 10 more minutes, and they will have something available for us before we get there, or when we get there.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I'm sorry that I have to do this now, but there was some confusion among the members about the Minneapolis, the meeting tomorrow and today. They are both Minneapolis School District.
Yes.
My meeting is tomorrow, and today is Senator Dan Larson, correct?
Yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jan Alswiger, Education Minnesota. I will keep my comments very brief. Education Minnesota would certainly support a longer school year as long as it was funded and there was a combination of instructional days and professional days added so that our members could have the quality professional development that they think that they need. When House Research did an estimate on the cost, last year, they came up with a figure of over $18 million per day, and now I've heard that the figure is $19 million per day. When you start adding up the transportation, the food service, and et cetera, it does become quite costly. So we're not opposed to it. We think that this is a possibility. I would just mention that you can't always compare a day to a day, because when we did have a requirement of a certain number of days, there were some districts that actually got waivers or variances from the Department of Education because of their their industry in their local area, and they asked for a longer school day so that they could still meet the hour requirements that were equivalent to the length of the school year. Well, and their school year was actually about 7-10 days shorter because they lengthened their school day. And when you look at other countries, you need to look at what their makeup is, and we can't always compare apples to apples. So in summary, we would certainly support it if it were funded and if there was professional development for our teachers.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Wicker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I support Senator Michelle's motion, though I recognize the fiscal restraints. But as a policy matter, when we review the work that goes into Minnesota's promise, world-class schools, world-class state, and what is it going to take, that's a part of what we need to put in the mix. Senator Stump gave good advice that we need to fund what we have, but let this be a part of the mix in our discussions and finance.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Just a concluding comment. I'm a real believer in balance and in working with everyone. And to my friends with the bobber, I would happily state quite publicly that I think, as we move this discussion along, we could find most, if not all, of these added days between Labor Day and Memorial Day. I think we could do that. As far as cost, that's a huge discussion. Again, in the past, this kind of proposal has been talked about with a phase-in. So instead of adding 2 weeks to your school calendar today, add 2 days this year, 2 more days the following year, you can phase this in and start to make that $18 or $19 million figure a little more digestible.
Thank you, Senator Michelle. Senator Michelle moves Senate File 465 to pass and be re-referred to the Finance Committee. Those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion passes. Motion carries.
Okay.
Thank you, everyone. We are now adjourned.
You're going to have to learn those things.
Thank you. This is
fun. About 3 hours of meetings tonight.
Coming back to different places.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
yes, it is.
See you tomorrow.
Jeff.
Oh, is it? Are you going in?
Yeah, but that's why, I mean, do you want to be on the bill?
I'm going to.
This is a bill.
Well, this is their name.
Thank you.
my phone. Oh. Where am I?
I heard of
both of them.
It's in there.